Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Australia's not a very religious country, and if you ask me why, part of the reason I think is that curiously, there appears to be so much grief associated with it all. Religions seemingly at war with each other, even conflict within individual brands of religion. Think of it this way, if it was a footy code or team, who'd want to join that club or code? For God's sake, is a refreshing exception to all the religious wars. It's a new book written by four Aussie authors, an atheist, a Jew, a Christian and a Muslim. And thank the Lord, they are civil and sensible, while able to be clear and open about their differences. I'm so very glad that we've been able to get all four of them together for a very open house conversation. They are Jane Caro, an author, columnist, broadcaster and atheist, Anthony Lowenstein, an independent Australian journalist, photographer, blogger and Jewish atheist, Simon Smart, a director with the Centre for Public Christianity, and Rachel Woodlock, an academic writer and Muslim. They demonstrate that, in Jane's words, respect and civility do not mean wishy-washy or timid. So we have Jane, Anthony and Simon in the studio and Rachel on the phone from Ireland, where she now lives. Welcome to you all to Open House.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. I want to start by asking each of you briefly how and why you came to your respective positions of faith. Because I think no matter where we are on the faith spectrum, it always is a choice about what to believe or not. Jane, can I start with you as an atheist?
Yeah, absolutely. I've realised that I'm quite unusual because I'm probably at least a third generation atheist, certainly on my father's side. We think the family was probably Jewish at some point, but there is literally no memory of that. There is no even ex-religion in my father's family. It's just a religion-free zone. Doesn't exist. My mother's side, her parents were Methodist and in fact met as Sunday school teachers, but she's such a lapsed Methodist one could call her an anti-Methodist, in fact. For me, like many people of faith, mine is an inherited position. I was born into a family where religion was simply not part of our discussion. And although I've had flirtations with experimenting with believing in things during my life, I guess I've rather comfortably in my 50s returned to the non-faith of my father's.
It's a very common story. Rachel, how about you? How and why did you come to an Islamic faith?
I've always had a belief in God, so that's not something that I've ever had to arrive at. It's just been something that has always been with me. But I also had to use, I suppose you'd say, my mind when I was studying Islam at university, and you know, I had to read a lot and make some decisions about what I believed. So it's a mixture of both my heart and my head, I suppose I'd say.
There was one moment you spoke to God like this in an outback town in far north Queensland. God, I give my life to you. And you say you were immediately flooded with beauty and love. But that was before you became a Muslim. It was independent of religion.
Yeah, that's right. I've never felt that it was connected to a particular religion. I really felt, at the time I was talking to God, I had just was completely overwhelmed with this sense that this was God. And so it never really has occurred to me that it sort of belonged to a particular religion.
Simon, can I ask you, how did you come to your position of faith then?
Like Jane, I was brought up in a family that had particular beliefs. In my case, it was a very Christian family. My dad was an Anglican minister, in fact. And so I say in the book, Jane and I are as original, as rebellious as each other in that sense. I'd like to think it's not as straightforward as that. I mean, I had lots of times where I was very uncomfortable with that belief in important. And when I was at university, I was sort of really much living like God didn't have much place in my life. But I couldn't ever ultimately get away from the God question. So it's things like the wonder of life, the amazing fact of existence that pushes me in that direction to begin with. I just can't get away from that. I guess I'm not satisfied with the thoroughly materialistic physical explanations of things like beauty and love and our search for justice, those sorts of things.
Anthony, can I ask you to explain what Jewish atheism is and how you came to that?
It might seem contradictory. In short, what that means is that there are very, very few Jews who would have said before the Second World War that they're Jewish and atheist. Obviously, they existed, but it was uncommon. What's, I think, happened in the last 60-odd years, particularly since the Holocaust, is a sense somehow that Jews who, in my case, I grew up in Melbourne, a liberal Jewish home. I went to synagogue a number of times a year, as most Jews do. For Jewish holidays, didn't keep a kosher home. My family then and now were liberal and in terms of their religious affiliation. But I think what's happened in the last 60 years is Israel, of course, was born in 1948, and the effect of that has been that for the majority of Jews before the Second World War, including my family who were in Germany at the time, the idea of being a Zionist, the concept of believing in a Jewish state, was completely bizarre. Why would you, as a Jew in, say, Dresden, where my family is from, want to move to Palestine? It seemed insane. Now, of course, the Holocaust changed everything for self-evident reasons. But the effect of, for many Jews, including me, is that I feel proudly Jewish in terms of the history of descent that exists within Judaism. But I don't practice my religion at all. And the reason that I'm atheist is I don't believe in God or any kind of affiliation religiously. And the effect for me and many, many Jews, unfortunately not enough Jews in my view, but growing numbers of Jews around the world, is a disaffection with Israel and the ways in which Israel treats Palestinians under occupation. And that is making, although Judaism and Zionism are not the same thing, it's self-evident to say that, and I'd explain that in the book, for many Jews, Israel has become the religion to replace their own religion of Judaism.
Yeah. Your book helpfully explores a wide range of questions, and each of you offer your own perspectives. I don't want to explore all of it and blow it all for now, but I do want to cover a few. The first one, the nature of the universe and what it is to be human. Simon, how do you account for all of that from a Christian perspective?
These are really critical questions, I think. And so one of the good things about this book is we get to explore those deep, important questions right at the beginning. And then a lot of the other things flow out from that. So Richard Dawkins says we have exactly, in the universe, we have exactly what you'd expect if there's no God. And that believers have to face that. And maybe he might be right. That's possible, of course. But I sometimes like people to sort of think about the implications of that belief of a meaningless, comfortless, valueless universe, which in my mind has to be at least to some degree if there's nothing outside of that universe. And so for many people, I'm a bit like this, like Anthony Flew, who was an atheist for much of his life and towards the end became a theist of some sort. He looked at the DNA and saw 3.5 billion letters in exactly the right order, decided that it just couldn't have happened without a God. And so I want to look at that and think about what sort of the reality that we live in. I don't think it's like Jane will tell us, which is that it's a sort of a neutral position to say there's no God. I think that has a whole lot of positive entailments, and I want to explore those.
Jane, what do you say?
I don't think it's a neutral position to say there's no God. I agree with Simon. It does have a whole lot of things that flow out of that. But my view is this, the fact that if something happens to me in my life that's really tragic and traumatic or very exciting and wonderful, it has enormous meaning to me. But for the vast majority of people going about their business who don't know me or anything about me, it has no meaning. Does that make it any less meaningful to me? No, it doesn't. It makes no difference. That's the way the world is. I see the universe in very much that sense. I don't think it knows I even exist or cares. It is benign. It is neither malevolent nor wonderful. It is just indifferent to another one of the things that's popped into existence because of its chemical makeup. That's fine. This is why I maintain, and I have no problem with that. It doesn't frighten me. It doesn't make me feel nihilistic or suicidal. I find meaning in my own life and my relationships with other human beings. That's as big as it needs to be for me. I see atheism, in fact, far less, it's often called arrogant, but I see it as the ultimate in humility because it says human beings are of no greater value than any other part of the universe or any other creature. Amoeba are us, as far as atheists are concerned. And for me, that is actually a really nice thing to think. It doesn't make me feel like a lesser creature.
Okay, second question. How do we know right from wrong? First, Rachel.
Generally speaking, every culture has a sense of justice, of right from wrong. We have something that human beings, even little kids, you know, when their toy gets nicked by another toddler, they know there's something wrong. So we have, there's a sense of right from wrong that is universal and sort of stands independent from arbitrary thinking about things. It becomes a little bit more complex when you have competing rights or competing wrongs, when you have to apply, you know, a little bit of thinking to an issue. But we have a sense of independent right and wrong. The difficulty is not so much knowing right from wrong, it's actually applying it.
Anthony, as a Jew, how do you determine in your mind what's right and wrong?
I think when I was growing up in Melbourne, and I'm in my late 30s now, so I grew up in the 70s and 80s, my parents instilled in me values that I guess you could say weren't really, I mean, they were Jewish to the extent that they were not based on the Torah, the Jewish holy book, but they were based on Western liberal values, I guess, of sorts. So I suspect pretty similar to all of us. There was no belief in enforcing an idea about Moses or the Ten Commandments. I mean, obviously, most of us can basically agree on the Ten Commandments. I mean, the idea, I think, about right and wrong is that we can't get away in the West from the concept of a Judeo-Christian background. That's where we come from. But these debates in some ways are relatively narrow, aren't they? Because ultimately, if we talk in the non-Western world, which of course is the majority of the world, the idea somehow that people will say when you go to India or Palestine or much in the Middle East, as I've often done for work, that for them the idea of someone like me who says that I'm an atheist basically doesn't really believe in a higher being that sort of informs me or I take lessons from my holy book, they find that incomprehensible. I'm not saying that saying that they're less intelligent. I'm simply saying that for them, the idea that one doesn't have a moral framework dictated by religion is incomprehensible. For me, what's right and wrong, and obviously I think we have a moral code that you can't ignore growing up in Australia, that it was informed by a, I guess, liberal religious background to the extent that I went to an Anglican school, etc. But in terms of how I live my daily life, it's relatively simple, and I agree with Jane. Be good to other people, be kind, don't hurt other people, try to avoid that as much as possible. And for me, as a journalist, I always see myself as a human being first and a Jew second, that as a journalist, I've often been attracted to the idea that we have a responsibility, to me, as if you're a good journalist, to actually give a voice to those who haven't had the opportunity to have that voice, and that's mostly underprivileged people or whoever it may be, and that's what I've done throughout my work.
Two issues combined for you, Rachel and Simon, the question of suffering and where do you find hope in life? Simon, I'll start with you.
I would acknowledge that this question of suffering is the biggest challenge to my faith. There's no question of that. The idea of an all-powerful, good God who somehow allows some of the most dreadful suffering to continue causes me my biggest doubts. I think there are a lot of unanswered questions in terms of that, in terms of my faith and that sort of God. But two things I'd say about that. One is this big story of this, of Jesus, for instance, is the story of a God who doesn't remain aloof from the suffering, but becomes part of it, who engages in that, endures it himself in this sort of strange way. But the other thing is that that story enables enormous hope of not only a future, but a future that impacts the present. And so that's what I come down on. I'm hanging on to that story as a very coherent, beautiful, logical story that offers hope in the present suffering, even if it doesn't answer all the questions.
Rachel, what about you? The question of suffering, and where do you find hope?
Well, suffering is, from an Islamic perspective, is part and parcel of the material world that we live in. We can only know good because of evil, unfortunately. So there is a sense within the Islamic world that even though we should resist suffering and we should try and change, you know, people who are suffering, we should try and alleviate it, that's just part and parcel of this experience that we're having. In terms of finding hope, again, I think that this is something that's innate to human beings. We have hope because we can see into the future.